You're listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James, and I'm your host. Welcome, dear kinsmen, dear kinswomen. Welcome, friends all over the world that listen to this show and that love the truth. Well, lots going on. Lots of things going on. The world is getting worse every single day, unfortunately. We shall just forge right through it. We shall not go to the left, not go to the right. We will stay on the straight and narrow road that leads to eternal life. We will let those that wish to travel the wide road that leads to destruction, let them do what they wish. For that road has always been there and available to everybody. Every day hell is enlarged because hell is insatiable. Like the hatred of the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, Scandinavian, Nordic, and Germanic peoples, the hatred of our people is being seen everywhere you look. It's an unjustified hate, but it's a hate nevertheless, and it's because of jealousy. It's because the have-nots can never be the haves. They can pretend, they can color their hair, they can put contacts in their eyes, they can drive an expensive car, they can have a job that another beast of the field gives them to make them feel important, but they still can never be us. And it's interesting that these have-nots that came here to steal from the haves, see, what it really means is the have-nots, they have no covenant with the Heavenly Father in heaven. We're the haves. And the reason why we are haves is not because of ourselves, but because we have a covenant with the Heavenly Father. We always have had a covenant. And it's a blood covenant. No, it's not any kind of magical thing or anything like that. It's a blood covenant. And that's why blood and bloodlines and racial things are very, very important. You can see that this world is so desperate at this point because they found out that the Anglo-Saxon white man is finding out how important race is. See, we've been told not to judge, as I've said over and over, a man by his race or his color or any of these things. But it's the very opposite. You should judge a man by his race and his color and those kinds of things. Race says a lot about a people. And I feel zero guilt. I don't know if you feel any guilt from what these Jews have tried to do, but I mean, there's zero guilt. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, I guess it affects different people different ways, but it has no effect on me. I don't feel any guilt whatsoever. Never did, never will. I'm happy that the Father loves us. Sometimes I wish I was never born because of this world. What good is this world? It's of no value at all. And it just makes me wonder, you know, why? But I know what's going on. As you know, we're under a test, and the Father could have just created angels again, but they could have rebelled against him. He's looking for gold tried by fire. In other words, tried and true, tested people that will remain faithful to him. And I can understand that totally. So, I figure we'll start the show. We'll get into Fritz Springmeier, but Let's start off with Comparé's, whom did Moses marry? Because this is a good question. A lot of people like to pretend that Moses married a black woman. You are familiar with the saying, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. This is true. A little knowledge is never enough. It never gets beyond half-truths, which mislead people into false beliefs. This is consistently true in the field of religion, more than in all other areas. I am frequently challenged on some point by someone who has just this little half-truth of knowledge. They think that they have found a fallacy in the Bible's great truth that Yahweh's people, Israel, are known today as the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Teutonic people. Israel is and always has been under Yahweh's command to keep their race pure. One challenge I frequently get is, why shouldn't whites marry Negroes? Moses married an Ethiopian woman. They base this on the way Numbers 12:1 reads in the King James Bible, and Miriam and Aaron spake against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. Christianity has never labored under a greater curse than the many mistranslations in the King James Bible. Some of these mistranslations are even followed in some other translations because these errors have become traditional. Bible scholars know that there are many thousand mistranslations in the King James Bible. The eminent scholar Robert Young, author of Young's Analytical Concordance to the Bible and of Young's Literal Translation of the Bible, says in the preface to his literal translation, in the King James Bible, there are scarcely two consecutive verses where there isn't some departure from the original. These variations may be counted by the tens of thousands as admitted on all hands, when you think you have found some discrepancy in Yahweh's word, some contradiction, which can be used as the foundation for conflicting doctrines. You can never safely rely upon what you find in English translation until you have checked it out in a good lexicon. The best reference is the Hebrew and Greek dictionaries included in Strong's Exhaustive Concordance, which is more thorough than most of the others. You will often find that defective scholarship in early translations has become accepted as doctrine. It is continued, although the original word will not support the meaning given in the translation. Let's get back to Moses and his wife. Numbers 12:1. The Hebrew does not say Ethiopian, it says Cush, a descendant of Cush, or a resident of the land of Cush. Remember that Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Genesis 10:6 tells us that the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Phut, and Canaan. Noah and his wife were both white, so their children naturally were of the same race. One of Ham's sons was Mizraim, meaning Egyptian. We know from all the Egyptian art, including their marvelously fine portrait sculpture, during all the many centuries of Egypt's greatness, they were a pure white people. In fact, during this time, any Negro found in Europe, other than a slave working in chains in the fields, was summarily killed on sight. Ham's son was Cush. Without question, he was also white. What about the land of Cush? They were two different countries named Cush in Bible times. One was Ethiopia, lying south of Sudan in Africa. However, there was another Cush in ancient times. It was in eastern Mesopotamia, or what at other times was part of the Babylonian Empire. Let me just stop here and say something. The Jews, I told you that the Jews say that Cush means black. So the Jews say, right? You know, in other words, when you hear the Jews say something, you kind of take it with a grain of salt, like certain people I know. You know what I mean? It's like, isn't it interesting that we're reading about what Eustace Mullins says Cush is, and now we're reading what Comparé says. Comparé, it just seems to ring more true to me. Is it because I want it to be true, or is it because it is true? It's because it is true. So it says here, these people certainly were not a black race at any time. This Cush flourished around 1500 BC during the time of Moses. The exodus from Egypt occurred in 1486 BC. Who can we expect to find living in this Cush on the east side of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers? From what people that lived there did Moses take his wife? In the first place, note that there is absolutely nothing anywhere in the Bible which says or even hints that Moses was ever in Ethiopia or any other place or any place else, he says, where he could have found a Negro woman to marry. The Bible does not tell us where Moses got his wife and who she was. Remember, Moses had killed an Egyptian who was beating an Israelite. In Exodus 2:15 through 21, we read, "Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. And the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, 'How is it that ye have come so soon today?' And they said, 'An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds.'" And also, see, they called Moses an Egyptian. "And also drew water enough for us and watered the flock. And he said unto his daughters, 'Why is it that ye have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread.' And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter." We know positively from this that Moses married the daughter of the priest of Midian. His name, Reuel, means friend of God. Yes, I was going to say this, that his name, that Reuel is Jethro. It'll say this now. Hold on. His name, Reuel, means friend of God, and it is given in the variant form of Raguel, in one or two places. Sometimes he's called Jethro. Jethro is the Hebrew word for Yithro, meaning his excellency. This is a title of respect, not a name. Who were the Midianites from whom Moses got a wife? In Genesis 25, 1 and 2, the Bible tells us that after the death of his wife Sarah, then Abraham took a wife. Her name was Keturah. She bore him Zimram and Jokshan, and told by Yahweh that his son Isaac, not through any of his other sons, would fulfill the great promises through his descendants. Therefore, he gave his inheritance only to Isaac, but he loved his other sons also and dealt fairly with them. Genesis 25:6 says, "But unto the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son, where he yet lived, eastward in the east country." Logically, he would want them to move more than just a few miles away, as the whole idea was to send them far enough away that they would not be neighbors of Isaac, and perhaps quarreling with him over the inheritance. The next place of any importance to which could go was Cush. Cush was in the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, the same country which at other times was part of the important Babylonian Empire. So Midian and his descendants became Cushites, people living in the kingdom of Cush. Remember, though, that by race they were descendants of Abraham, closely related to Isaac and his descendants, the Israelites. However, they remained a separate nation and never became part of Israel. Since this is the only wife the Bible tells us Moses had, it is clear she was a Midianite whose family lived in Cush in the Tigris and Euphrates valleys. See, that's not in Africa. You know, if Cush means black anyway, right? We have Montenegro. That means Black Mountain, right? So we have all kinds of places that are called, Black Water, Black Mountain, It's just a color. This is where Moses would logically have found his wife. Moses fled for his life because the Pharaoh of Egypt wanted to kill him. Moses could not have gone just to some tiny neighboring kingdom to stay. A neighboring kingdom would have not have dared to give Moses shelter, but would have turned him over to the Pharaoh as soon as the Egyptians learned that he was there and made a demand for him. Therefore, Moses fled a safe distance to a land where the people did not live in fear of the powerful Egyptian empire. He went to Cush, among whose people were the Midianites. We may be certain that Moses never married a Negro. Remember that he was brought up in the Pharaoh's palace as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. He was an educated and as an Egyptian of the royal family. The Egyptians considered the Negroes as merely wild animals to be killed on sight. Jeez, I consider them the same today. The son of royalty would not take a wife from the Negro Cush in Africa. It was while Moses was guarding the flocks of his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, that Yahweh appeared to him in the burning bush. This was when Moses was commissioned by Yahweh to go to Egypt and set Yahweh's people, Israel, free. When Moses returned to his own people, he taught them their proud heritage as Yahweh's people, Israel. He also taught them that they must keep their race pure. His brother Aaron and his sister Miriam taunted Moses about his marriage outside the strictly limited group of Israel. It is true that he had married a woman who was not an Israelite. However, she was not only a white woman, but a descendant of Abraham, a close relative of the Israelites. So this matter of the wife of Moses can't be used as a justification for race mixing. Moses did not marry outside the white race, just outside his nation. Mongrelization is equally a sin against both races. Yahweh had his own purposes in mind when he made different races. Each was made suited to the purpose of Yahweh and what he had planned for it. To lose that suitability by mixing it with another race is to defy Yahweh, the results of which are always bad. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. So, I think that clarifies it very easily. I mean, I see nothing in Negro women that would make me want to marry them or even have sex with them or anything. To me, they're an abomination. And, maybe I am to them, you see, and I have no problem with that. See, everybody should love their own race. I mean, schools of fish like to hang around with their own fish, with their own, that's why they hang around in schools. They don't want to hang around, like lions don't want to lay around with the tigers, It's just not natural. It's natural to want to be with your own race. There's nothing to feel guilty about. There's nothing wrong with loving your own race. It's just ridiculous. And I don't care what any Jew says, I love my own race. I don't care what a Jew thinks. I really don't care to ever hear a Jew speak ever again. I don't care what they think. I never did, and I never will. And if you would just be that way, you don't have to worry about being called racist or any of these other things. What are you going to do about it? I love my own race. What are you going to do about it, Jew? So, there you have it. So it's interesting to, find out that the Jews are always involved in trying to cloud the issue, and they always want to promote race mixing in some form or fashion, using a perversion of words or a perversion of scripture or something like that. You know what I mean? Well, if Moses married a Negro, then what's the problem? Moses didn't marry a Negro. You know that as well as I do. You don't even need that to be proved to you. You just know it's not true. So, let's go into Fritz Springmeier's Be Wise as Serpents. We're on page 423, chapter 2.3, A Revolution in the Minds of Men. You will learn how the Unitarian Universalist Church ties in with the Illuminati and Freemasonry. You will find out the biography of one of the most influential Masons in U.S. history who is relatively unknown, Hosea Ballou. You will discover the little-known details of how Unitarians and Masons conspired to create revolution in the U.S., which led to civil war. Let me read that one again. Can you think of that this is happening today? You will discover the little-known details of how the Unitarians and Masons conspired to create revolution in the U.S., which led to the Civil War. What did I tell you about all revolutions, that the Masons are involved in all of it? So yeah, they're even involved in the Revolutionary Civil War. They're involved in the revolution of the minds of men, the sexual revolution, etc., etc. What is Yale's power? Harvard was started as a college in 1636 and Yale in 1701. A Harvard alumnus who planned to send his son to Yale said, "All Harvard men are working for Yale men." Why is it that Yale men have so much success over Harvard men? Why? What is Yale's power? Also, what is the Unitarian Church's power? There were Lutherans, Catholics, long before there were any Unitarians in this land. Lutherans outnumbered the Unitarian Universalist Church by over 60 times the membership, and the Catholic Church is over 300 times the size of the Unitarian Church. But the political power of the Unitarian Church has been enormous compared to these other groups. For example, there have been at least 4 Unitarians elected U.S. president. There has never been a Lutheran, a Pentecostal, or a Mennonite president. There has only been 1 Catholic president. Why? What is the Unitarian Church's power? Well, I told you that the Kennedys have Jewish blood running through them, so he may be a Catholic, but that's just another Jew president. I know you want to say, well, he did some good things and he rebelled against. He was a very filthy man. Don't tell me about how good he was. The power. The power of the New World Order, or the Jew World Order, is the power of the Unitarian Universalist Church and Yale College, now University, which was associated with the Unitarians. The Universalist and Unitarian churches have been essentially Masonic denominations. Are you hearing this? Can you imagine? Another Masonically controlled educational institution. Let's continue. It was appropriate that when the Jew Illuminati and Illuminated Masonry branched out to the United States, that they chose the Unitarian Church as the important center of their activities. They followed their pattern of founding Jew Illuminati cells in universities, such as they had done at the University of Ingolstadt and the group, quote-unquote, at All Souls College, Oxford University. Yale was a natural shoe-in for them. And it was from Yale University, a center for the Jew Illuminati, that 3 Yale men in the 1850s went over to the University of Berlin to learn Hegelian philosophy, which they imported back to the U.S., and totally revised American education. Listen again, listen to the term, their revolution in how we teach our children to read is why phonetics are not taught. And the look-say method, even though students learning phonetically are reading better and national reading scores are going down with look-say, they obviously have other educational priorities. Who are the Unitarian Universalists? The Unitarians and Universalists have merged their denominations. A brief overview of the Unitarian Universal Church will show how the church fits into the Jew world order. Today, they openly promote the New Age movement and a universal church. It resembles Reformed Judaism so closely that Rabbi Kahan said Unitarianism is indistinguishable from Reformed Judaism. Are you listening? See, let me just stop there. Why every time I look into a pulpit do I find the Jew? Or the Mason, who is twice the child of hell? How come I just find some guy? I was just talking about him on Rabbit Hole Radio Show. How come I look into these people? Then I look into Hagee and all these different people, and no matter where I look, I find the Jew or the Mason. Why is that? I mean, you know why. That's the trick of Judeo-Christianity. That's the Jewish trick of Jewish Christianity. These people are constantly. Let me just show you something that I saw today. Let's just take a little quick break here, and I'm going to show you a little something that might give you some clues about Judeo-Christianity. Now, let me see if we can whip over here, and let's find Kenneth Copeland again, because I want you to see something. Now, this man, it's all about the Apostle Paul, and you'll understand this. Remember, I told you there's only three scriptures in the whole Testament of the Bible about the New Covenant. And you know that I've told you that the New Covenant is with the same people as the Old Covenant was with. All the New Covenant really is, if I was to explain this in a couple of sentences, is that the Father, instead of having the law outside on written on tablets, he has written the law in his children's hearts. He took the same clay. I'll do a teaching on this. He took the same clay that was all marred up, broke it into pieces, and reshaped it. That's what the New Covenant is. There's no magic. All it means is that he has written his law in our hearts to give us an advantage. It is not what these preachers are saying it is, or what the Apostle Paul says it is. Now, everything to do with these people, I'm going to tell you that Kenneth Copeland, his gospel is a gospel of the covenant and faith only. Listen as I go through a bunch of these real quick. The covenants of promise. The power of faithfulness to God. The love covenant is power. The love covenant will fight for you. The love covenant is a healing covenant. Let's see. Now, he has a few arbitrary ones too. But as you go through this, racism must end. I'll have to check that one out. Okay. A supernatural economic turnaround. A lot of these are called virtual victory campaign. He talks about covenant chesed endures forever. The word chesed is something to look into, but he always bringing this up. Chesed is reserved for God's family. Fear blocks healing. Fear is not okay. Faith in God's love drives out fear. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. The God of plenty. The answers are in your born-again spirit. You see? Develop your born-again spirit by refusing to budge. Merge your will with God's will. I like that one. Absolutely persuaded of your covenant. Your covenant is everything. Covenant faith is powerful faith. The covenant overrides your circumstances. Covenant faith is full faith. When you're fully persuaded of your covenant, the covenant meal that will heal, what your covenant really means, the stranger to heir through the covenant, from stranger to heir through the covenant. See, life without Christ is life without covenant. Judgment is executed on COVID-19 by Ken. that was very illuminating, let's say. The significance of a blood covenant. The covenant name change. Set your course for healing and long life. Fully persuaded faith. The commandment of faith. The faith that takes. Focused faith. Determined faith. These are all different teachings. Persistent faith, part two. Aggressive faith. The nature of faith. The birth of bulldog faith. The covenant promises a long, strong life. Have faith in your covenant with God. Your new covenant name. El Shaddai, our covenant-keeping God. An unbreakable covenant. God is a covenant-keeping God. Your covenant relationship with God. Be covenant-minded. It's covenant day. The power of covenant relationship. Receive your covenant promises by listening. Receive your covenant promises by the blood of Jesus. Become fully persuaded to receive your covenant. Receive your covenant. Step into the power realm and to receive your covenant. Faith says, then does. I think I've made my point. This fellow says that faith is a spiritual force. He says that, like when I was speaking about this before, he said that when the woman who had the issue of blood touched Jesus' garment, that Jesus could do nothing without her faith. What he's implying is that God is powerless to do anything without your faith. You should think about that for a while. God is powerless to do anything? Well, geez, I didn't have any faith in him creating the world, but he was powerful enough to create the world, wasn't he? Without my faith. The Father has seen to it that he gave me a place to live. It's his place. He owns the land. He owns the house. It really had nothing to do with my faith. He took care of it. And I'll get into this later. Like I said, Copeland and the fellow Pearsons with him, who I believe is a Jew, they say that the more faith that you have, the bigger of an airplane you can have. So faith and materialism are very important. Because God wants you to be rich. How ridiculous. How absolutely ridiculous. If hardly a rich man can get into the kingdom of heaven, why would he want his children to be rich so that they would be set up so they wouldn't be able to get into the kingdom of heaven? You see? And why would you need faith if you were rich? you'd have faith in your riches rather than faith that God would be able to take care of you, correct? See, there's a lot of deception out there, ladies and gentlemen. Did you hear what I just read about all the messages I just read? Is that not amazing? So let's continue. Who are the Unitarians? A brief overview of the Unitarian Universal Church will show how the church fits into the Jew world order. Today, okay, I just wanted to read it again. Today, they openly promote the New Age movement and a universal church. It resembles Reformed Judaism so closely that Rabbi Kahan said Unitarianism is indistinguishable from Reformed Judaism. The rabbi said, listen, quote, the American Jewish religious theories that came into being included the Reformed brand whose distinguishability from the Christian Unitarianism was evident only to the keenest of scholastics and philologists. The Unitarian Church has its share of Jewish members, and the original founders often have links to important bloodlines. If this church is so powerful, why haven't people heard of it? Good question, says Fritz. In 1852, the Unitarian Reverend Theodore Parker praised the high-ranking Mason Hosea Ballou, 1771 to 1852, for having created a revolution in the thoughts and minds of men more mighty than any which has been accomplished during the same time period by all the politicians of the nation, unquote. If the Mason and Universalist Hosea Ballou wrought such a powerful revolution in men's minds, why doesn't history record his achievement with fanfare? Perhaps the same reason they haven't advertised how the order wrought such a revolution in America's educational system. The control and direction they have given our lives is far more pervasive than most Americans have any clue about, and they most likely prefer it to remain that way. The Unitarians and Universalist churches were originally separate. Outside the Masonic Lodge, or away from the Masonic gatherings, the Universalists and Unitarians during Hosea Ballou's day went separate ways. The Unitarians were Universalists, belief-wise, in disguise, and later the groups would merge. However, at the time of Ballou, the Unitarians were still congregational in name, and up until the early 1820s, still received state money collected from the universal religious tax levied upon the entire population for the support of the established congregational church. Although the Unitarians did not believe in the concept of sin, the atonement of Christ, the deity of Christ, the judgment of Christ as the Almighty, the miraculous conception of Christ, and many other fundamental Christian doctrines, they carried the label Christian. And in the U.S., a nominally Christian nation, they were supported until 1820. Now, let me point this out again now. Did you get this? Unitarians did not believe in the concept of sin. They did not believe in the atonement of Christ. They did not believe in the deity of Christ. That means you're an antichrist, correct? No wonder the Jews like them and talk about it being Judaism, right? Another proof, ladies and gentlemen, that Christianity did not spawn out of Judaism, because Judaism is antichrist, just like this Unitarian church, right? The Unitarians did not believe in the concept of sin, did not believe in the atonement of Christ, did not believe in the deity of Christ, did not believe in the judgment of Christ as the Almighty, did not believe in the miraculous conception of Christ, and many other fundamental Christian doctrines. You dig? You see how these denominations of Christianity are now, we've already looked at the Masons, at the Jehovah's Witnesses. We've already looked at many of these sects. They're all fallen away. The Catholics, we find out none of them are really Christian. And then that fellow down there, Reckhart, rec art that I was talking about yesterday. He is part of the Apostolic Church. And of course, everything that he quotes and talks about has to do with the Apostle Paul. No wonder, hey? No wonder the Jewish version of Christianity is stemmed and based upon the Apostle Paul's writings. Absolutely 100%. The more you look at it, the more you'll see it, the more you'll understand. Remember, this fellow said, that clinches it. You went against the Apostle Paul. That's it. I'm not going to listen to your videos. Well, don't waste your time listening to my videos, Mr. Jew. These messages aren't for you. Incredible. I mean, incredible. Everywhere I look, everywhere we're looking here, we're finding that the Jew is involved. The Jews are involved in the Unitarian and Universalist Church. They're involved in the Methodist Church, we saw, right? The Methodists were bringing Negroes in. Mr. Tittle was bringing Negroes in to dance with the white girls in the hopes that they would mix. He loved equality, which is very Freemasonic and very Jewish. But see, the Jews don't really believe in equality. They don't really believe in liberty as far as they want to destroy our liberty and are doing so at the very moment and have been doing so for thousands of years. It's a different liberty, as I keep telling you. Their liberty, equality, and brotherhood, it's a false brotherhood, a mixed race brotherhood. They are a mixed race mob of a motley crew of mixed races, the Jews are. So naturally, they would love a brotherhood of many races. Right? Right. So, it's amazing. It really is amazing. In contrast to the wealthy and influential members who made up the Unitarian churches and received state support, the Universalist churches were made up of common people. Let's take a break here. I'd like to take you back in a time of America which still reflects how we feel today. I love this little piece.
Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. Gather all those equals up and herd them on the pier. America for white, Africa for black. Send those apes back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. 20 million ugly cums already on the pier.
In there, man. I ain't gonna get on that boat. Look like that boat leaked to me, man. Oh, man, you have the best white man ever, but here I come.
America for white, Africa for black. Send those apes back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. Boats are ready for the trip, we won't shed a tear.
Like nobody don't love us nice colored folks anymore. Oh,
no. America for white, Africa for black. Send those apes back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. And that chimp is ugly stick, and that buck is spear.
Just a minute there, man. I just got my bottle of wine back there on the dock. Oh, man!
America for white, Africa for black. Send those apes back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. 20 million jigaboos, Africa will steer.
How are we going to find Africa, man? We ain't got no compass. How are we going to find that island, man? Oh, man!
America! Africa for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. There they go, far out to sea, see them disappear.
Hello, hello back there on the dock. I believe this boat is leaking, man.
America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. Boats are leaking badly now, this ink we sadly fear.
Help! Help! Please take it out! Help!
America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. No more niggers, civil rights led by nigger queer. America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. Our homes, our schools, our city streets of niggers will be clear. America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ring that bell, shout for joy, white man's day is here. America will be all white, the land we love so dear. America for white, Africa for black. Send those eight back to the tree, ship those niggers back. Ship those niggers back. Ship those niggers back. Ship those niggers back.
Ah, ladies and gentlemen, may it be so, may it be so. America for whites, Africa for blacks. That's the way the Father wants it. Welcome back to the Saxon's Creed radio show with your host, David James, brought to you by DavidJamesBoston.com, your source for the truth. You know, some people will hear that song and they maybe have joined the channel and then they will quit the channel just by hearing something like that. And it's very interesting to me how words touch the programming of people's minds. I've explained to you many times about the N-word and that it just means black. And yet they will be triggered. They've been taught and trained. I think at one point I would say that I was the same way. I thought it was kind of like, well, why use that word? You know, you could be a little, have a little class and use, you know, just try not to use that word. But in reality, I think it, to use it is to deprogram people and desensitize people to the word. It's not that, you know, trying to be some kind of a degenerate or something like that. It's too, I'm working on words and to deprogram people from these words. Even the word white, just like the word nigger, has programming effects, has nuances that touch people's programmings. So these need to be destroyed and dismantled. And the best way to do it, like the word racist, they've used the word racist so many times it has no meaning anymore, which is a beautiful thing. The word nigger has no meaning anymore in the sense it just means black, but, you know, the niggers have used the word so much. I mean, it shouldn't mean anything to them. Isn't it interesting that they would get upset about it? They use the word all day and all night. Like, as it's part of their language. Why would they care if anybody says that word? It's just foolish. Anyway, back to the book. Hosea Ballou misrepresented and ignored by historians. To dispel some of the misrepresentations about Ballou, the Universalist Historical Society published a book. One myth that they did away with was that Hosea Ballou was the originator of his own religious beliefs. The book's author, Ernest Cassara, criticizes past writers on Ballou. Most serious of all, their work nourished the myth that Ballou was purely an original thinker. They believed that he had arrived at his theory of atonement, his Unitarian concept of God, his Arian concept of Christ. Now, that's not Arian as in white people. That's that Arian the other way. You remember the Jew Arius? You know what I'm talking about? The Arian conspiracy, the Arian... What's the word? You know what I'm talking about. So, and the many aspects of his thought simply through independent study of the Bible. Hosea Ballou was more influential in his time than the New Thought Unitarian Masons such as William Ellery Channing and Ralph Waldo Emerson, who have both been given more attention by historians than Ballou. By the way, William Ellery Channing had a Jewish heritage. Oh, I'm so surprised. Another Jew? And Ralph Waldo Emerson was raised by his Mason stepfather, Ezra Ripley. Emerson praised his stepfather's religious views. See the connections, ladies and gentlemen, to the pulpits? See how everywhere we look, the stink of the Jew is there? And the Mason? Power of the written and spoken word. The story of Hosea Ballou shows the power of the written and spoken word. How much support during his lifetime did Masons give Ballou? There would be an extensive study. However, it is easy to pinpoint the three biggest influences upon his life. Fatherly influences aside, Ballou was greatly influenced by a mystic named Caleb Rich. Geez, I wonder if he's a Jew. The second big influence was the Masonic author Ethan Allen. Geez, I wonder if that's a Jew. That name is usually a Jew name, right? And the final big influence, particularly upon his theology, was the book of the Masonic deists of that age. Ballou's life parallels Joseph Smith's and C.T. Charles Taze, Russell's in some ways. Hosea Ballou's early life has affinities to both Charles Taze Russell and Joseph Smith Jr. All three came from families that appear to have had great expectations religiously for these men. Like Charles Taze Russell's mother, Hosea's died when he was young. He was only 20 months old. And like Russell, he was very close to his father. However, unlike Russell's father, Ballou's father was opposed to his universalist ideas. In spite of his opposition, his father did accept his son, and there weren't any hard feelings between father and son despite of Hosea's changes. The mystic Caleb Rich converted Hosea and most of Hosea's siblings to universalism. In turn, Hosea later converted his oldest brother. How do you like that? Caleb Rich. Hello. In the genesis of his beliefs, Ballou, like Russell, challenged a local authority to answer his questions. Elder Brown, another name, of Westfield, failed to answer his questions. Ballou, in his late teens, increasingly hardened his universalist beliefs. While a youth, Ballou had been interested in the lodge, and as a young man, he joined. More about his Masonic career later. In 1789, Hosea and most of his siblings, brothers, and sisters joined the Universalist movement. Remember again that the Universalists don't believe in Jesus Christ and the deity of Jesus Christ or in sin or the atonement, etc., etc. Okay? It's anti-Christ. His brother was a type of homespun philosopher. Hosea himself had very little formal education. Though rich in native intelligence, he was always to suffer from the lack of a good, thorough educational background. His accomplishments were to be made in spite of his deficiency. Later, Hosea converted his eldest brother to universalism. In terms of family support and education, the three Masons, Russell, Smith, and Ballou, also had affinities to each other. Now, Jerry, you see that Joseph Smith was a Freemason. He used to carry a talisman in his on him, and it was found on him when he was killed. You must realize what that really signifies. Ballou's first influence, Caleb Rich, the mystic universalist with possibly a Jewish heritage, possibly, I'd say definitely, who would influence the Ballou family so much, moved into a nearby town the year Hosea was born. This mystic received his theology from a series of dreams and visions. Caleb Rich, on the basis of his vision, started a church named the General Society, quote-unquote. The General Society had members from the nearby towns of Warwick, Richmond, and Jaffrey. It is considered likely that Hosea, as a boy, participated at some of the General Society's events. Some of Hosea's relatives joined this General Society. Ballou's second influence, the next influence on his life was the Mason, again possibly of Jewish heritage, as I told you. I guarantee Allen is a Jew. Ethan Allen, his book, Reason, the Only Oracle Man, changed Ballou's thinking. Reason, the Only Oracle of Man. In other words, God is not needed, you see. Allen's Masonic membership has been debated back and forth. The author tends to side toward the evidence that he was a Mason. Records from lodges back then are often non-existent, and it is not that perilous to believe statements of people that he was a Mason. Masonry was very strong in that area and not only influenced Ethan Allen, but listen, Jerry, but also the family of Joseph Smith. The connections between the Universalist Church and the origins of Mormonism will be discussed elsewhere, as well as the Masonic tie-ins. Ballou himself cites Masonic deist writers as the source of his views. It may be proper for me here to state one circumstance, which no doubt had no small tendency to bring me onto the ground where I have been for many years, felt established. It was my reading some deistical writings. By this means, I was led to see that it was utterly impossible to maintain Christianity as it has been generally believed in the church. Ethan Allen's book was rather rare, because after lightning struck the print shop and burned up most of the newly printed books, wow, the printer destroyed most of the rest because of the book's atheistic views. At least one copy circulated among the Universalists from hand to hand, most likely, and Ballou read such a copy. From Allen, what was the name of the book? Doesn't really say, does it? From Allen, Ballou learned to examine everything, especially Scripture, from the light of reason. The doctrine of the Trinity seemed contrary to reason to Allen, so Ballou, following his cue, also rejected the Trinity. Allen was forced, because of his rejection of the Trinity, to change his view from the atonement of Christ, so he dismissed it altogether. He's an Antichrist Jew. In the pulpits and everything else, right? Or he's a Mason or whatever. And he's influencing people in the churches, right? Discarding the atonement of Christ meant discarding the concept of sin. Allen's book, which he had called Oracles of Reason, right? I'll see if that's possible to even find that thing, and others, called Ethan Allen's Bible, had a profound effect upon Ballou, as is evidenced by Ballou's 1805, A Treatise on Atonement. Ballou's third influence, Ballou also was familiar with another Mason deist, Thomas Paine. Although he didn't share Paine's views, he felt that they were healthy for true Christianity. Ballou wrote that he felt rigid Christians have done more to harm the religion of Jesus and his open enemies from Celsus down to Thomas Paine. His close friend Caleb Rich got him together with his wife-to-be, the daughter of one of the few Universalist families in the area. Although the Masonic reference book, 10,000 Famous Freemasons, is generally accurate, it does make a mistake about Ballou. Contrary to their statement, Ballou was not ordained a Baptist minister. Rather, in the fall of 1789, the Baptist Church excommunicated him. However, the Universalist Church did ordain him in September 1794 at their Oxford General Convention. Jose Ballou then went on a nonstop preaching traveling schedule similar to the three Masons, Charles Taze Russell, Lorenzo Dow, and William Miller. More Jews. He preached nearly every evening. Isn't that wonderful? Imagine that just like Hagee, he's just another Hagee preaching, but he doesn't believe in the deity of Jesus Christ, but he's teaching people that perhaps believe he does. As he subliminally brainwashes them and turns them into, you know, Christians that don't believe in Christ, which is crazy. That's what Hagee does. There's a lot of talk of Christ you heard with Hagee, right? And then he also, I thought of this as well, Hagee also made sure he talked about abortion. He wanted his stance, you know, he's a very conservative half-breed. Let's continue. In May 1802, four Universalist groups formed sister societies in the Woodstock area. They named their societies the Liberal Catholic Society of Woodstock, the Independent Catholic Society of Woodstock, the Catholic Benevolent Society in Heartland, and the Universalist Society of Bethel. Leading citizens of that area joined the Universalist societies. So it is possible that other Masons in the local became involved with the secret societies or with these societies. Ballou's Masonic career, after being raised in one of the lodges of one of the towns he lived in during his early years, he moved to Dana, Mass. In 1794 and then to Barnard, Vermont in 1803. Ballou became active in the Masonic Lodge. He is known to have preached at a Masonic festival in June 1806 at Chester, Vermont. I'm going to skip down a little bit. Is there some connection between the Puritans and all of this? The story behind Hosea Ballou goes way back. Perhaps a good place to start with the passing of the English crown from the Tudors to the Stuarts. The rule of the Stuarts was a significant influence in the development of Protestant thought. One example of the change the Stuarts brought is seen in the marriage of Elizabeth Stuart to Frederick of the Palatinate. These two, to realize the ideal of hermetic reform centered on a real prince, created a culture, a Rosicrucian state, with its court centered at Heidelberg. The Stuarts were intimately involved with the spread of Freemasonry and are regarded as the source of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Although certainly the groundwork had been laid by that secret Tudor prince, Sir Francis Bacon. During the Stuarts' reign, advocates of all kinds of extreme millennial views appeared in the Anglican Church and the Puritan movement. At Edinburgh, an Edinburgh translation of a German work, Dornier, on the person of Christ, had an appendix by Dr. Fairbairn, which introduced Socinianism to its British readers in the 17th century. In the year 1691, this appendix's thought appeared in Dr. Bury's Naked Gospel. The Naked Gospel, which was too much for Orthodox thinkers, was publicly burned. Whiston, in 1708, kept the stream of thought flowing, as did others until 1782, with Priestley and Belsham as leaders. The Unitarians met in London for the first time as a church body. Priestley himself became in succession, an Arian, a Socinian, and lastly a Unitarian. See, the Unitarians believe exactly what the Arian heresy. That's what the term I was thinking of before, the Arian heresy. Remember, we learned all about that. Remember that Arius was a Jew. Again, right? And look, this church, the Unitarian Church, comes about in succession with the Arian heresy. Isn't it interesting? The Jew permeates, the vermin constantly entrenched, constantly within, and got the, and have themselves lodged in. Lodged. Get it? The lodge. You lodge something into your eye. You lodge something into the corner. You lodge. It's locked in. You know what I mean? You're lodged in. And nobody's going to get you out. They get in your home and get lodged in. You see? Vermin. Isn't it interesting? The relationship between several types of thinking can be summed up by quoting from an article, Unitarians, in the Dictionary of Sects, Heresies, Ecclesiastical Parties, and Schools of Religious Thought. Modern Unitarians, the school of Priestley, who are principally of England and America, are the successors rather than the lineal descendants of the Socinians. I'll spell that for you. S-O-C-I-N-I-A-N-S. The Unitarian sect was formed out of the Arianism floating in the church and in dissent. Remember, Arianism means that Christ is not God. Just to briefly summarize it. The Arianism sprung from the Dutch Remonstrant theology, which was largely studied in England. Arminianism, historically Arminianism, has led to Arianism and thence to Socinianism and Unitarianism. Too many isms for me. Socinianism had strong German and Polish Jewish ties and origins. In other words, although some of these isms are thought of as Christian heresy, if a person examines back to their roots, one discovers their roots in the past were not Christian. Initially, the Unitarians used Presbyterian chapels for worship. Are you listening? But later shifted to Puritan churches. Professor F.A. Christie has done a scholarly work entitled The Beginnings of Arminianism in New England, which details how the early Puritan church in New England had advocates for Arminianism within it. The beginnings of the Unitarian movement in the U.S. go back to the first Puritan settlers, some of which were Unitarians but nominally called Puritans. The Puritan churches are now called Congregational churches. Are you listening, folks? The Congregationalist Reverend Experience Mayhew gave a message in 1744 in favor of Arminianism. Another minister, William Pynchon, in 1650, wrote in favor of liberalism and meritorious price, his meritorious price of our redemption. The beginnings of the Unitarian movement go back to the first Puritans, and some of these families involved links to Jewish bloodlines. Again, this is supposed to be a Christian church. What do we see in the pulpits? What do we see? Everywhere we look in these denominations, we see Calvin Coffin, the Jew, who says a little usury is okay. See, in other words, gradualism. First, no usury is okay. Then just a little is okay. And now look what we've got today. Everywhere you look in the pulpit, practically, including the Catholic Church, the top dog is a Jew. And many of those others are Jews too, the ones that touch the children. I'm sure there's people that are twice the child of hell that touch children too. It's a requirement for the devil's minions. But you see, the Congregational Church, the Puritan Church, the Unitarian Church, the Mormon Church, the Jehovah Witnesses, and on it goes. The Congregationalists, right, okay, we just read that. So again, the beginnings of the Unitarian movement go back to the first Puritans, and some of these families involved links to Jewish bloodlines. The Universalist movement also can be studied in the lives and writings of such Puritan pioneers as Reverend John Murray, 1816, and Reverend L. Hannon Winchester, 1836, John Mayhew, 1763-64, and Charles Chauncey. Chauncey's universalist views can be seen in such works as The Mystery Hid from Ages and Generations, 1784. The historian will also note that these liberals were in correspondence with British Unitarians. Thomas Belsham's Memoirs of the Late Reverend Theosophilus Lindsay, M.A., 1812, provides a look at the communication kept up between the British and American liberal Congregationalists. They weren't yet known as Unitarians. These were also ties to Jews. What is the Father showing us, ladies and gentlemen? And everything has to do with the Apostle Paul in all these denominations, because it's the Jewish version of Christianity. Isn't that interesting? The Apostle Paul and the devil were able to use his writings to take over Christianity and control the narrative up to the moment. Amazing. So he says there were also ties to Jews. For instance, one prominent early Unitarian minister, Reverend Samuel J. May, records how close his family was to the Jewish family of M.M. Hayes. M.M. Hayes was also an active Freemason, and Samuel called him uncle. Perhaps to date, the best historical look at the movement is Richard Eddy's Universalism in America, Volume 1, 1636-1800. Harvard College, now university. Harvard was started by the church and became a hotbed for liberals such as Henry Dunster and Charles Chauncey. For instance, Reverend Joseph Avery, 1751-1824, graduated from Harvard with honors in 1771 and went forth as a prominent congregational minister practicing magic. Hello? Are you listening? The Salem witch trials were but a small distortion of the symptom of an occult problem under the Puritans. Did you hear that? Some hold that the witches were the ones who were involved in condemning the women. If so, that would tie in with other information that indicates one of Joseph Smith's ancestors was involved in condemning the women to be burned. Early links between Unitarians and Masonic Revolution. Harvard, a church school, brought in professors like Karl Follen of Gießen, Germany. Karl Follen helped create the Bund der Jugend, League of Youth, in Europe, which was a revolutionary movement, with links to the Carbonari and the Masons. These movements at times moved under the guise of the Swiss Bible Society. In August 1819, ministers met at Carlsbad, Germany, and denounced the movement, which then was broken up by the arrests of its members. In late 1824, Follen left Switzerland to be a Unitarian minister at Harvard. Later links between Unitarians and Masonic Revolution. Our next topic is a group of Unitarian conspirators who are relatively well-known in American history as ministers and for things other than revolution. Remember what I told you about the name Brown. Now, I have no proof that John Brown is a Jew, but you decide. John Brown is a legend of American history. John Brown had a group of men who led intent on starting a revolution, a slave revolt that was meant to have far-reaching effects. But John Brown did not do this on his own. What men supported John Brown, supplied him with his money and arms? And who was the real John Brown? John Brown was a Mason. Thanks to the Masonic scandal, the murder of Morgan, John Brown was now being drawn toward the idea of conspiracy and secret organization. While many men were leaving the lodges because of Morgan's murder, Brown was attracted to it. Bear in mind that contrary to popular mythology, Brown knew little about the Bible. He knew of one verse, "The wages of sin is death," and he literally believed that it meant if someone sinned against you, you could blow him away. It is reported he picked up this revolting idea from hearing a Mormon sermon. The Rosicrucian leader George Lippard, member of the Brethren of Light, get that, who was seeking to create a brotherhood which was to be a poor man's masonry, personally influenced John Brown to become rabidly anti-slavery. John Brown's eldest son, John Brown Jr., who was also murdered and stole alongside his father, was a faithful Mason. John Brown Jr. was also a lecturer on phrenology. Phrenology was immensely popular among those turning away from formal religion. Three avid students of phrenology who also supported John Brown and his sons, besides the actual Secret Six, were Dr. Samuel Howe, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Senator Charles Sumner. Masonic historians have tried to characterize John Brown as anti-Masonic, but this author finds nothing to substantiate that claim. They make a big deal that supposedly John Brown said the rituals were silly. Whether he did or not, simply calling the ritual silly is no indication that he was anti-Masonic. Indeed, his uncle was master of the Hudson Lodge, number 68, where he was raised as a Mason. John Brown worked with him and other Masons during his lifetime without any problems. For instance, August Amschel Bondi was a Jewish Freemason who fought with John Brown in the Kansas battles of Blackjack and Osawatomie. I think you say Osawatomie. One might better describe these battles as butcheries. Anyway, this Jewish Freemason, Amschel Bondi, before he joined with Brown, was a longtime revolutionist. Not another revolutionist Jew or Freemason. No. Having fought in the Masonic-created Metternich Revolution and against Spain in the Masonic-created revolution in Cuba. Geez, this fellow gets around the world, this filthy, dirty Masonic Jew, fighting in all kinds of revolutions, in all kinds of lands. The Scottish Rite's New Age magazine has an article about how the Masons started and led the Cuba Revolution. Another tie-in that John Brown had with the occult was his membership in the Rosicrucian fraternity. He was on their World Council and Council of Three. One of his Rosicrucian fraternity brothers, William Lloyd Garrison, would help him in starting armed revolution to free the slaves. Garrison had joined the American Rosicrucians first, established the American Anti-Slavery Society in 1832, and became a member of the Order of the Rose in England in 1834. Let me just stop with a thought here now. Let me explain to you something. I see what the slavery movement is now. I get it. Why would the Jews want to bring these blacks into this land, use them as slaves, blame it on the white man? That's one reason, right? But why would they want to free them if they were using all of them as slaves on their plantations? Well, number one, they knew they were useless and were too costly to keep as slaves. But number two, this is the technique. And see, this is a pattern of the Jews that I see all the time. See, they got them into our nation and they had them in their plantations. Only 1.6 of American whites owned any slaves. 1.6. Now, why would they want to do that? Well, let me show you the technique. Whites did not want to have blacks come and live in the North here or anywhere else. So what the Jews did was they brought them into their neighborhoods, like Harlem or Roxbury in Massachusetts. Then when they got them in there, most of the Jews left so that they now had a place and were entrenched. Well, that's the same thing that slavery. First, in other words, they freed them onto the public and now they had them occupying an area. Does this make sense to you? You see, and that's what slavery was all about. They brought them here. We didn't want them here. We didn't ask them to come here. They got them into their neighborhood, so to speak. Same thing. And then they did Masonic revolutions like this and so on and so forth and had, you know, the Jew Lincoln. He's a Rosicrucian too. They had them free the slaves and now they were entrenched in our lands. You see? See, I never even realized that until just this moment. Does this make sense to you? Because that's what it is. That's exactly what it is. See, they couldn't just say, well, hey, American people, we want to bring black people here. Everybody would have rose up or said no. So they found a different way of going about it. Just like nobody would have them in their neighborhoods in the north, in Roxbury and Harlem and all places all around the country. But the Jews brought them into their stolen territories until the point, of course, they didn't want to live with them either. Some of the merchants would stay there and make money off them, but most of them just moved out. And then that freed them to have a place there. See how that works? Freeing of the slaves is the same thing. That's a revelation. The inner group of the conspiracy for Brown's revolution. The secret, see, a revolution, I tell you, is a rebellion against the Father. It's a rebellion against God's will. It's a rebellion against the Israelite nations of the world, which are the heavenly establishment on earth. You know how it says, thy will be done on heaven as it is on earth as it is in heaven. You see, on earth, the Father's will is to be done in the Israelite nations. But these rebels rebel against that and try to change it, and they do. The secret six, which was the inner core of the conspiracy for armed revolution, were Reverend Thomas Wentworth Higginson, Reverend Theodore Parker, George Stearns, Garrett Smith, Franklin Benjamin Sanborn, Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe. The inner group might better be described as Unitarian than Masonic, because although some were Masons, it is known that the group itself consisted of Unitarians. This core group consisted of six men who in turn can be traced back to the Bird Club. Before giving the history of their plotting, the mentioning and the contributions of others, let us examine these six men. Unitarian Reverend Theodore Parker was a big reader. His personal library was 12,000 volumes. He associated with the social experiment of Brooks Farm, at Brooks Farm, and believed in evolution before Darwin. Reading his book, A Discourse on Religion, for that one, he was privately educated but passed Harvard's exams, 1830 and 31. Parker wrote that, dial in 1840, God will create a soul yet larger and nobler than Jesus. Listen to that. Did you hear that? To lead the way to a more perfect religion. Oh, these devils. Reverend. George Stems. Now, it said Stearns back there, but okay, now he changed it to George Stems. A Unitarian born in Massachusetts, was a friend of Emerson's. He was an upper-class Bostonian lead pipe manufacturer that was before lead was known to be poisonous. That was before lead was known to be poisonous. Reverend Thomas Wentworth, 1823 to 1911, was a Unitarian pastor of the First Religious Society of Newburyport, Mass., and married Mary Channing. Garrett Smith was a multimillionaire. He had more land in New York State than any other individual. His father was a partner with the Jewish Mason John Jacob Astor of the Astor family. and that the Astor family has ties to the Jewilluminati group in England. Garrett Smith generously gave 140,000 acres of land to destitute free blacks. Unfortunately, most of the land was lost by the blacks when they were unable to pay their land taxes. Although nominally a Presbyterian, he is on the public record as saying that Satan is the author of Christianity. Are you listening? Franklin Benjamin Sanborn. I knew it. It says, yes, they named him after Benjamin Franklin and named it backwards, you see. Franklin Benjamin Sanborn, 1831 to 1917, was named after the famous Mason Benjamin Franklin. Yes, they named him after him backwards. He was the pro-transcendentalist. It's hard to say these words. He was a pro-transcendentalist and a Unitarian. A brief history of the conspiracy behind John Brown. Charles Sumner had been interested in Masonry and involved in revolution for a long time. He had made personal visits to occultic revolutionists in Europe, including Mazzini. He excited his fellow Bird Club members with his revolutionary talk. Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe, G.L. Stearns, now it's back to Stearns, F.B. Sanborn, Charles Sumner, and Reverend Higginson were members of the Bird Club. They met in Young's Hotel in Boston. From this group came much of the core of the conspiracy to create an armed revolution. These men were not alone in supporting an insurrection. The origins go back to such famous men as Ralph Waldo Emerson. Ralph Waldo Emerson learned Swedenborgian from his friend Woodworth, who was one. Emerson was a Unitarian reverend of Boston's Second Church and was found after 1829 to be diligently studying such Masonic writers as Rousseau, Goethe, Swift, and pagan works such as Aristotle and Plutarch. His sermons were spiced with references from Socrates to Confucius. He wrote a book on the Masonic Swedenborg's religious thinking entitled Observations on the Growth of a Mind, of the Mind. I'm going to finish this paragraph. Another early abolitionist was William Ellery Channing, both a Freemason and a Unitarian minister. Channing also studied and was influenced by Rousseau, Voltaire, and other Masonic authors. Channing believed the Bible was a storybook, not a trustworthy authority. He felt the Trinity belief was idolatry and polytheism. He felt Calvinism was immoral. John Brown had very little religious scruples, nor very defined theology. He did have hate for slavery, which was sparked by reading abolitionist material. Finally, history finds all the plotting and planning and shipping of guns and ammunition, etc., culminating in the raid on Harper's Ferry. The raid and its hoped-for insurrection was primarily the work and finances of the Inner Six, although John Brown supplied most of the wild military plans, dreams, quote unquote. Newspapers like the New York Tribune, which had Jewish Mason Karl Marx as one of their European correspondents, made John Brown into a mythological hero. The New York Tribune, the New York Times, the New York Post, the Boston Traveler, and the Chicago Tribune all built up the mythical image of John Brown as the Moses-like figure. In reality, the man was nothing of the biblical saint that they described him as. We're going to stop right there, ladies and gentlemen. And we're on page 432. Are you learning many things? Are you enjoying finding out about Christianity? Do you wonder why Christianity has fallen to its knees? Wonder no more. You're being shown these things. Inside of this book and outside, as you well know. Glory to the Father in heaven. For without him, I have no idea how any of this can come about. I'm just riding the wave and doing my best to obey. You've been listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James, and until next time, study to show thyself approved.